Baker Tilly Greenwoods is one of the oldest independent auditing, accounting and advisory firms in Cape Town, focused on navigating the complexities of transactions and the intricacies of compliance, risk management and financial reporting. In this series, we will guide you through the complexities of today's business landscape. You are listening to Advisory Explained, a trusted perspective. Welcome to another episode of Advisory Explained, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of business, law, and advisory services to provide you with valuable insights and perspectives. I'm your host, Kwesi Kretzinger, and today we have an exciting conversation lined up that's sure to resonate with anyone involved in business deals or corporate governance. When businesses engage in major transactions, like mergers and acquisitions or even restructuring, legal oversight is critical, but it's not just about compliance. It's about having the right legal advisor who understands the bigger picture and works alongside other professionals to protect and grow the business. Today, we are joined by a truly remarkable guest, Robert de Rooy, who is here to talk about the role of a legal advisor in complex deals, on boards, and how legal agreements can be more than just transactional documents. Robert is also a pioneer in the creation of comic contracts, which take a unique approach to simplifying legal agreements, making them accessible and understandable for everyone, not just lawyers. In today's episode, Robert and I will discuss the necessity of having the right legal advisor when doing deals and why legal counsel should be connected to the other advisors. We'll also dive deep into the difference between transactional agreements and relational agreements. Finally, we'll explore how comic contracts are making legal agreements accessible and transparent for everyone involving, improving understanding and building trust. Whether you are an entrepreneur, a business leader, or a legal professional, today's conversation will give you a fresh perspective on the role of legal advisors in shaping successful business outcomes. Robert, thank you for joining us today. It's really a privilege to have you here.
It's my pleasure.
Obviously, the entire podcast and the series we're doing is around advisory, which encompasses all of the different areas, which is legal, financial, operational, all of these areas. So how would you describe then the necessity of having the right legal advisor in every complex transaction and, well, on business boards?
I think people have a choice when they employ legal advisors. They can employ a legal advisor as a tool who they can give instructions, and provided they're lawful, that legal advisor will execute it. Or you can have a legal advisor as a partner, as a, someone who's on the journey together with you and who understands what your best long-term interests are. And so I think it's a kind of relationship that you're looking for with your lawyer. If you are looking for a lawyer as a tool, often that lawyer is brought in at a late stage, when oftentimes the heads of the agreement has already been discussed, more or less agreed, people have started moving towards what they thought was an optimal agreement.
Yeah.
Whereas then that lawyer is kind of stuck with a set of facts that he then has to deal with. And it's often very difficult to turn that around.
Mm.
Whereas if you have a relationship with a lawyer, you bring them on board early, then you have a much wider view of what your possibilities are.
Yeah.
And your lawyer will also very quickly identify issues that are likely to impact on your transaction. For example, tax.
Yeah.
If there are any other issues, labor issues, those are things that your lawyer should be sensitive to and can help you, if not himself, or herself, but help you get the right resources and trusted advisors to participate in structuring a good transaction or a good relationship going forward.
Okay, I really like how you approach that in terms of saying getting the right people from the beginning involved. It's very difficult to, especially when I look at our side on the corporate finance side, just as you said, a lot of times business owners, they start discussing and almost negotiating deals with buyers or sellers in a deal. And then at the end of the day, we get called and everyone gets pulled in and say, listen, this is the deal, make it work. But a lot of times that deal doesn't work. And now you have to sit with the baked potatoes almost in front of you, and you have to sort of figure out how to best approach this.
Yeah.
So from your perspective, in a situation like that, because obviously best case is clients understand the role of a trusted advisor, specifically a legal advisor in your case, and bringing you in from the beginning to ensure the deal gets done right or the transaction gets done right. But what would your approach then be if that's not the case? Because unfortunately, it happens quite a lot that that's not the case, that we are pulled in at a later stage and it's almost crisis control on certain elements to improve that. So what would your high-level approach be in a situation like that?
I think it's always best to take a long-term view.
Okay.
And oftentimes, as they say, you know, your first loss is your best loss. So to the extent that parties might have gone down a wrong path or a suboptimal path, it's best to try and put it on the right path, even if it means incurring extra costs, spending more time, and taking good advice. You know, a lot of these transactions have all been done before, and a lot of your advisors would have done them before, and they have the benefit of those experiences, and they have the benefit of being able to show you what options you have. And again, if you keep your eye on the future, making sure that you have an agreement or a relationship going forward that is balanced, that is not exploitative, that is that's ultimately going to bring you the success that you're hoping for by entering into that transaction. It takes work up front, because once the document is signed, that is fixed.
Yeah,
it's fixed, and people often think, oh, but I just signed the document and then we can kind of get on with making it up as we go along. That's fine as long as the relationship is really great.
Yeah.
But often it's not. And so, yeah, you need to really make sure that you have described and captured a well-considered agreement that's a solid foundation for the parties to achieve what they hope to achieve, and ultimately for both parties to achieve the success, however they define that success.
Absolutely.
And that's another important thing in contracts, and whether it's relational agreements or mergers or, you know, transactional agreements, people don't spend enough time to actually define what success looks like.
Yeah.
Contracts often define success negatively, in the sense that if you don't breach this and that term, if everyone complies 100%, then that's, in a way, we assume that is success. Yeah. It's not defined.
Almost success if you don't breach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's very negative. Whereas people don't actually try and articulate what the success of this relationship will look like. And that's a pity, because if you do that, both parties need to know and understand what they can do to contribute
to that
joint vision of success. Also define what failure looks like.
Yeah.
And because then you can adjust yourself and your behavior and your resources to avoid failure.
How would you then approach an agreement like that? if we say not to have a non-failure based success contract, essentially. So saying that, how, well, let me rephrase my question in terms of, how do you bring in the success of a transaction without focusing on the negatives?
People often approach a transaction with an assumption in their mind as to what they want and what the other party wants.
Yeah.
They never express themselves in those terms. So they actually never check whether the expectations are aligned. And the only way to make sure your expectations are aligned is to express them and to articulate them and to check right up front, are we really aligned? You know, have some of the slightly awkward conversations about what might happen if things go wrong. Look at the scenarios. One of the big reasons why people litigate is because when something bad happens, they often attribute that to some type of opportunism on the other side. But what actually happens is people didn't discuss these things up front. They didn't anticipate it. And then whenever that bad thing arises, people resort to looking at the document, which may or may not benefit them. It'll be pure luck because no one really thought about it. And then they'll hold on to that point. So, but when you discuss these things up front and you discuss these scenarios, people are less likely to attribute your response to a negative outcome as opportunism, which gives you a much healthier basis on which to try and get that relationship back on track, whether by way of negotiation or mediation. You can then bring things back on track, especially if you've got your purpose clearly identified, because then you can align whatever's happened back towards your purpose.
Yeah. Would you then say that a trusted legal advisor, so that having the right trusted legal advisor, almost articulates and plans out post and beyond just the compliance and the agreements? It's almost integrating the future and planning for the future and how to really bring that into every step while we're busy with and almost pre-engagement.
I mean, it would be ideal, but it's not the reality. Often times, time is money. There's a lot of pressure. So you don't have that luxury of kind of workshopping an agreement in this way. If you're a legal advisor, and it's not just whether it's the right legal advisor, sometimes also having the right client.
Yeah.
Someone who's willing to be open to discussing things and who's not just focused on extracting maximum. So it's a, as I said earlier, it's whether you have this relationship, this partnership with your client to see, okay, how can we together and with other advisors, how can we form a bit of a team here where everyone plays their part to achieving that goal? And a lawyer's role in some ways is facilitative, where you can discuss these things within the bounds of what's lawful, what's possible. I think in that sense, a lawyer that can facilitate those discussions around a contract when the opportunity is there, that would be ideal.
You mentioned there having the right team and almost working with your client as a team. One of the ways that we've discussed it in the past is where you specifically are actually on the board of directors of specific clients. How have you experienced that helps you to almost mitigate a lot of the risk of joining a transaction too late or having to fix problems the whole time instead of facilitating early enough to plan ahead through and then to the agreement stage of transactions, deals, etc.?
Yeah, it's a very privileged position to be in, for to be invited to be on a board of a company then have the opportunity to understand and to contribute towards the decisions taken, it gives you a much more strategic insight into where the business is going, what the business needs. Because so if you have your own wider view, and your view is not limited to whatever the instructions are that you receive from the client, which normally would be what that particular individual thinks is important or not, you often discover that certain things were not thought not to be important, even though you wished you had heard it before, because it actually is important.
Yeah.
And so being part of a board helps you to understand that. And then it also helps you to be a voice, often a voice of reason, in terms of what is possible, and also to avoid or steer clear of situations where you might end up in a risky situation, whether it's litigation, competition authorities, etc.
You know,
those are perspectives that you can bring to bear on the board discussions.
If I understand you correct, almost if you have the right legal advisor on your board, essentially, if we speak holistically, it almost helps not only on a strategic basis for planning and development, but it helps in terms of long-term decision-making and guiding, because you have as a legal advisor, my understanding is that while you are on the board, you are exposed to so many different facets of the company, of the industry. Your ability to give better direction, better guidance, and then ultimately on transactions, how to navigate risk through agreements, and also how to implement strategies and success measures in agreements. My understanding is that that would be a significant benefit to have your legal advisor on the board.
I think so. I think as a legal advisor on a board, the most important thing is to actually learn and listen, because there's a lot that you can learn from the other people on the board. There's often other independent directors who are very experienced, and your executive directors who have hands-on experience of the way the realities of that business operates. And so you need to be alive and really listen, not to think, look, I'm a lawyer, I've got a legal opinion, and now, as they say, when you carry a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
You know, now you want to solve every problem with a legal solution. Sometimes problems don't have legal solutions. They've got business solutions, or they've got operational solutions. But sometimes, you know, even if the legal issue is not a solution, you can tell the board, look, law is not going to help you in this case. And then they know, and they can move on.
Or the law's not on your side in this case.
Yeah, or it just isn't the most optimal way of going about it.
Absolutely.
You have to look at sometimes people want to litigate, and then you have to say, okay, well, how much is this going to cost? What are our chances of success? How much management time is this going to suck away from doing the business?
You know?
Are we fighting for a better future, or are we fighting for a better past?
Yeah.
So those are things that you can discuss at a forum, like a board meeting, in a way that, and before some of these matters become, in inverted commas, personal.
Yeah.
When people, now it's, okay, we're going to fight. And
So
you can have a more reasonable discussion.
Can you maybe give us a very high level idea of the process of litigation? Because I think a lot of people, they don't know what it entails. They don't know, listen, if I went into a contract and stuff happens and we're going to litigation for some other reason, people don't know the process. They don't know who's involved, how long it takes, costs, etc. Obviously, I know every litigation is different, so it takes a different amount of time, different costs depending on who's involved and all of that. But if you can sort of give a high-level idea just to the listeners, what to expect.
Okay, I can only speak from what I've seen in my own experiences.
Yeah.
But typically, litigation starts off with a lot of passion.
Mm-hmm.
People are upset. They feel hard done by. And there's a feeling, you know, we'll fight this as a matter of principle, whatever it takes. Then you have to sit together with your legal advisors. You have to decide, am I going to, is it an action procedure or is it an application procedure? The difference being the action procedure ends up in a trial with witnesses in court giving evidence, whereas an application procedure proceeds based on affidavits and papers. And then papers have to be drawn up. They have to be issued. There's a lot of costs involved in that up front. The counterparty has an opportunity to respond, whether it's in both cases. And once the what they call the pleadings have closed, there's a process where you have to gather all the documents. That's called discovery. That's in the trial process. And often that's kind of when you see the other side's version of events and you see all the documents and everything has kind of started to surface. You realize, maybe my case isn't as strong as I thought, and here's some vulnerabilities, etc. And now that initial passion is already a little bit started to fade. You've had your legal bills have started mounting. And so now it's not so, but now you're in it.
Yeah.
So now it's hard to back out.
Yeah.
And that's when often shortly before the trial or the hearing takes place, people become very sober. And oftentimes that's when the lawyers can contribute by achieving a reasonable settlement.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then if you do go to trial and you, even if you win, the case can be appealed. So it's often a very unsatisfying experience.
Yeah.
Best to be avoided.
Based on the information that that we've discussed today and in the past, having the right legal advisor from day one, it won't necessarily save you the entire litigation process, but it might stop you from going into a litigation process which is unnecessary.
Yes. Look, sometimes it is necessary to litigate.
Yeah.
And you, especially if you're a defendant, you've got no choice. You have to defend. So it's a choice that needs to be made with a high level view of the field, if you want. People often stand too close to the map when it comes to dealing with problems like this.
Yeah.
You need to take an overview of the map and really see where all these different paths might lead you to.
There's a concept that we've discussed in the past on the difference between transactional agreements and relational agreements. And I think there's a fundamental difference between the two and how you approach these two different agreements. And I do think a lot of fights come because people don't understand the difference between the two and they approach them incorrectly. So I don't know if you can comment on the difference between the opinions and how you would approach each of these two different types of agreements.
I distinguish between a transactional agreement and a relational agreement. So, for example, a transactional agreement would be when you're buying a car or you're buying a house. It's an agreement that has a very short lifespan. And there, it's very important to make sure that the agreement is detailed correctly and accurately and that the mechanics of that agreement are very clearly thought through. So it's more an operational exercise.
Okay.
Relational agreement would be sometimes a lease agreement, for example, or a shareholders agreement, where it's a longer term agreement. Things might happen that are unforeseen. And That is where you need to spend quite a lot of time on, as we mentioned earlier, what is the purpose?
Mm.
What do we want to achieve? What does success look like? What are our fears and concerns?
Mm.
And make sure that there are mechanisms to deal with them. So there are things like having provision for a renegotiation or a mediation, having structures in place, identifying who the representatives are, making sure you have regular status meetings. If it's, for example, an SLA, to make sure that you provide for the health of that relationship on an ongoing basis. So they are, but oftentimes the artifacts, the documents, the clauses look pretty much the same, and people are applying clauses of the one and the other without really distinguishing between the fact that these two these two categories of agreements have a very different nature.
Yeah. I'm also sensing that a large part of the difference between the two agreements, one is circumstance, but also the other side is the end user of the agreements and where they are going. We'll still get to it a bit later, and I've touched on it a little bit earlier, but the importance of how an agreement is drafted. I've had to learn a lot of legal jargon, how certain processes work, how certain clauses are drafted for risk, etc. But for most people, when they see a contract, red lights go on. They are out of their depths. Especially when they start seeing all these Latin words following up on each other, and then you know, people get they lose their minds. Which I completely understand, because that's how I feel a lot of the time when I read new contracts with new clauses and new Latin agreements, phrases, etc. How do you approach drafting agreements? Because I know one of your main points that we've been working on, especially, is having agreements that's workable, readable, and understandable for the end user.
Reverting to the theme of relational agreements, and even, I suppose, transactional ones, where the mechanics are important.
Mm.
These agreements have to be executed. They have to be done, lived. People have to comply with them. Things have to happen at certain times.
Mm.
And the people that do those agreements, that live those agreements, are often not lawyers.
Yeah.
So if you take a step back and realize that the contract is the manual of that relationship, it doesn't make sense to draft that manual in a way that no one can understand, especially not the people that are supposed to be executing that agreement.
Absolutely.
So there is a movement or a growing body of lawyers that kind of defines as the kind of proactive law movement, where you take into account the fact that with some agreements, it's engineers, it's accountants. There's a lot of different people that participate in executing that agreement. And so the agreement needs to be written in a language that everyone understands.
Yeah.
Often, contracts are documents that are written by lawyers for lawyers.
Mm.
They're not written for the users of that agreement. You know, if we look at how our society has evolved, you know, people, you know, take any app, any website, most of the stuff that you buy in your car, you know, if you look at your car, the way that, where the steering wheel is and everything, you know, the user experience is so critical to that product.
Mm.
But for contracts, it's as if the user experience is irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because the user experience is so poor, as you said earlier.
Mm.
People don't take into account that contracts should be written for the users.
Mm.
For where the users are at, using the language that will help them understand the contract. Mm. So that's the approach. The approach is to write agreements in a language that the users of that agreement will best understand.
Absolutely. You mentioned in your previous answer that a lot of times to each contract, specifically transactional, when we look out of a corporate finance perspective, for instance, you've got the perspective of the accounting team, how this transaction should be accounted for. Then you've got the perspective of the legal team and how the agreements should be drafted per the ideas of the deal. Then you get over to the operational side, the people on the ground who actually has to go implement this and do the work and integrate. And on the other side, you've got your tax specialists. And there's so many people around the table with different perspectives. And each of them have an idea and opinion on how this transaction should happen and how the wording almost should look at the end of the day. And then when you get to a contract, you get this almost a mixed salad at the end of the day. You've got a bunch of different stuff in that's not structured as ideally as possible. And on that note, I almost want to ask you the question of, as a trusted legal advisor, how would you approach a transaction, for example, where you have all of these different parties playing a role and they're all giving the best advice to the business owner at the end of the day in terms of their perspective, how the engineers see this thing should happen, how the accountants see this thing should happen?
Yeah, I don't think it's as overwhelming as that.
Okay.
There's often a transaction, something has to be done. It's very rare that it's truly new.
Mm-hmm.
And it's often a matter of establishing what are the facts, what does the landscape look like, and then adjusting from the different perspectives what has to happen here, mm-hmm. what is the most optimal solution. Obviously, you might have, or the one side might have their view on that, the other side mm-hmm. might have their view on that. There's discussions that mm-hmm. that then take place to try and come to a heads of agreement. And then it's a matter of synthesizing those that path into language that everyone can then also give you feedback on.
Yeah.
Because it's dangerous when you're not checking your assumptions.
Mm.
So as a lawyer, when you are drafting something and you're assuming that you got it right, best to check, you know, with the different advisors. Again, I think listening well is important.
Yeah.
Making sure you're really hearing what someone is saying and not what you think they should be saying.
Mm. Or what you want them to say.
Yes. And because otherwise you're not going to really be able to synthesize that into language, into the contract. And that's another point that is important, is oftentimes lawyers will try to retrofit a transaction into a document.
Yeah.
Because they've developed a nice set of precedents over the years.
They've got a template.
They've got a template. Now, sometimes templates are relevant and they are useful, but it's dangerous when you try and retrofit a transaction into a template. Better to describe the agreement as it is, and then look to your templates as a checklist.
Okay.
Based on what this agreement actually is about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's just something I thought is important. I just have to mention.
No, that's absolutely important. And what I've experienced in the past and on one of our previous clients that we worked together on, there was quite a big shock. And I think that was the first time I actually worked with you on a client where we drafted an agreement there was an agreement drafted for a transaction for the client. And the agreement turned out on like 79 pages. And we sent that through to you, and it turned out that you could break it down into significantly simpler wording and take out a lot of fluff that wasn't necessary. And I think at the end of the day, we sat with 22 pages in an agreement that you drafted for us. And for me, that was an eye-opening experience on it's not necessary to take as the long road almost and to say it in as many words as possible. But it is possible to put your agreements, to put your legal world almost in fewer words, in understandable words, and it's still not just a valid contract, but it's a appropriate contract at the end of the day. Now, on that, I want to move over into the appropriateness and wording of contracts. And one of the big reasons why I also invited you on to the podcast is comic contracts. And what you have done there, taking legal agreements, some complex agreements and some lesser complex agreements, but putting them into visual illustrations for individuals, employees who either do not have the knowledge to understand what they are reading, or even that do not have the ability to read and understand.
Yes. Thank you. So, exactly. Comic contracts are contracts for illiterate people at the most kind of extreme level. A lot of, for example, in South Africa, illiteracy is a real problem. Farm workers in the Western Cape, for example, there's nearly 40% illiteracy.
Sure.
It's not an absolute illiteracy in the sense that they cannot read very basic short sentences, but it's an illiteracy, it's a functional illiteracy where you certainly are not able to read a paragraph of text, that especially when it starts cross-referring to other paragraphs, etc. So what we do is we visualize those clauses as specifically as possible. So if you think of a safety card in an airline,
yeah,
where those are the instructions everyone has to follow. Doesn't matter what country you're from, what language you speak, whether you everyone is expected to understand those safety instructions. So that's the kind of foundation of our thinking. We do add headings and certain things in text, but they are often readable and easy to understand, especially within the context of the pictures.
Yeah.
But the most important aspect is that pictures are engaging. People are attracted to pictures, so they engage with the material. So yeah, so we create visual contracts, and at the one end of the spectrum for people that are illiterate, but also for groups where you have multinational groups working. You have different migrant groups working on certain farms in certain industries. People are working on building sites from different languages, different cultures. So we their images are a universal language.
Yeah.
So people are literally, if you want to call it, on the same page.
Yeah.
As far as what needs to happen, when it needs to happen.
Absolutely.
And so, and the other important thing is that our visual contracts are not just understandable when they sign it, they are understandable when they need to be referred to. A lot of people will make an effort to explain a contract to someone who can't read it, but the point is, once he signed it, he might have an idea of what he signed, but when it comes to checking, you know, how to apply for leave, etc., cannot do so with reference to the document. And we aim to create our contracts such that illiterate person, that vulnerable person, is in the same position as we are, that can read, to be able to refer to a document and to guide their behavior and to set out what their rights might be and what processes they need to follow to get satisfaction.
Absolutely. And I completely believe, and I think it's actually, I don't know if it is, but it should be a basic right to be able to understand what you have to sign if you are obligated to sign something, and not to be forced to sign a contract if you by choice or not by choice, have the understanding and the ability to understand what is in that contract.
We live in a market economy,
mm.
and you cannot participate in the market economy without contracts. And so if you want to live in a market economy, you have to sign contracts. But yet, yeah. such a large proportion of our population are not really in a position to fully understand the contracts that they are binding themselves to.
Mm.
And look, there are efforts in our law, you know, National Credit Act and the Consumer Protection Act do try to address this problem by obliging companies to write documents at a level of literacy that the average user of that document can understand.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, text as a medium is still way above what a lot of the people can actually achieve.
Yeah.
So how do we bridge that gap? And visuals, I think, is a very effective way of bridging that gap because it's how our brains work.
Mm.
We've evolved with the hardware to process images thousands of times faster than text. And there's so much more information that you can take in with images other than text. That's why the instructions to assemble a piece of furniture or something that you buy at a DIY store,
yeah.
that comes in pictures. It's not described in text because
yeah.
it's easy to follow.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I do think it's important that there's a more effort put into helping especially vulnerable people understanding and also treating them with the dignity that their decision about their future matters.
Incorporating the comic contracts and the visual illustrations, that, in my opinion, would foster a significant better relationship between the employer and the employee. Because I think, my perspective says the employee will understand, listen, my employer is doing his best to communicate with me in a way that I understand.
It certainly signals that you care.
Yes.
And that can do no harm to a relationship.
Absolutely.
Secondly, you're avoiding misunderstandings and problems
mm.
that can be avoided. You're not going to avoid all problems.
No.
But there are a lot of things that happen because people just don't know
mm.
what to do. Or they ask someone who also has a half an idea.
Yeah.
So, it's certainly a way of solving problems and avoiding problems. And I think what is strong about it is the transparency. It's being transparent about the relationship. It's about aligning expectations up front
hmm.
and not leaving things to assumptions.
Yeah.
And it also empowers vulnerable people because then they have an opportunity to respond.
Mm.
And lastly, it democratizes information because you are allowing everyone in that group or in that cohort, whether it's farm workers or subscribers to an insurance policy or people that are participating in a clinical trial, etc., to understand things the same way.
Mm.
So it becomes much more embedded knowledge, mm. And it allows for peer pressure.
Mm.
You know, if we have seen it with disciplinary actions, where the farm workers, if they know this is the deal, you've got to pack this much of this fruit that looks at this color, and someone doesn't do it,
mm.
that person doesn't get much sympathy if they fail.
Yeah.
And all the correct procedures have been followed because it's clearly understood. These yeah. are the rules and we're abiding by it, so why aren't you?
Yeah.
Whereas if those rules are not clear and someone is suddenly in trouble, you've got sympathies that are misplaced.
Yeah. If you can maybe just quickly share on how the listeners can contact you if they are interested in either working with you maybe discussing the opportunity of you assisting them on a transaction on the one side, or on the other side, getting involved on COMEC contracts. Obviously, we'll also add all the links in the description of today's podcast. But if you can just quickly touch on how to get a hold of you.
So for COMEC contracts, please reach me at robert@creativecontracts. So that's creative with a, and then hyphen contracts with an S, .com. Otherwise at robert@deroy, deroy.co.za. And yeah, I'll be happy to help.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Robert. That brings us to the end of today's insightful episode with Robert Deroy. We've explored how the right legal advisor can make or break a deal, why having legal counsel integrated into your board strategy is crucial, and the power of agreements that go beyond transactions to build meaningful business relationships. Robert also introduced us to the groundbreaking COMEC contracts, which are transforming the way legal agreements are understood and used in business. The key takeaway today is that legal advice should not be siloed. Advisors must work together, aligning legal, financial, and strategic goals to ensure a successful outcome for the business. And as Robert emphasized, agreements are not just about compliance. They are tools to build lasting trust partnerships. Thank you for listening to Advisory Explained, A Trusted Perspective, a podcast by Baker Tilly Greenwoods. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and reach out to us via our website, bakertillygreenwoods.co.za.